The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, JVC Broadcasting Management, or its sponsors.
Welcome to Crime and Justice Radio, where we talk all things crime, justice, mayhem, and the courts with expert insiders and legal outcasts. I'm Aida Leisenring, and I'm here with Bruce Barquette. Bruce, how's it going?
Great. How are you, Aida? Looking forward to the show tonight.
Me too. And, hey, listen, I learned something new about you today.
What was that?
That you really like Madonna.
I do.
Whistling to Like a Prayer on the way over here.
It's one of her best songs. She's the, what did I say, John Lennon of the 80s and 90s. So there you go. You gave me up. You outed me.
Speaking of greats, tonight we have one of the ultimate insiders. And who's that, Bruce?
Commissioner Patrick Ryder, Nassau County Police Commissioner. So we can't get much more of an insider than that. He's going to come on and discuss the spectacular results Nassau County has had. The safest county in the country. Lowest crime rate dropping while the counties around it are soaring. And remember, Nassau County is on the border of New York City. So that's no small feat.
It is not. We're going to talk about other aspects of law enforcement. We have a pretty amazing story I hope to get to that Aaron Moriarty of 48 Hours just aired concerning two individuals that are serving a life sentence, and the prosecuting attorneys in their cases have issued public apologies saying, "We were wrong, you're innocent, I'm so sorry." And
please let this individual out of prison. And the courts and the governor in Missouri are saying, having none of it, telling them they're going to stay there because we're not so sure.
And we're also going to discuss on the opposite side of that, prosecutors fighting to execute two individuals, really three that we're going to focus on. But Rodney Reed is a pretty well-known death row inmate in Texas. His hearing starts today. Prosecutors are opposing his stay of execution. He has an actual innocence claim. Richard Glossop, who also is on death row, he has no criminal record prior to this matter, and he also has a pretty compelling case of innocence. So we should get right to it.
And don't forget about Julius Jones. These are cases where individuals are facing the death penalty. Not only are saying that they shouldn't be executed, they're saying they're actually innocent, with varying degrees of evidence supporting their claim. So we want to follow these along, chat about them week to week as the events develop. And of course, I'll mention again, Julius Jones was the featured on your show, The Last Defense, which aired on ABC a few years ago. And really, you brought his case to light, and now he's got a ton of supporters and followers. His hearing comes up in September, so it'll be interesting to see what happens. So tell us about Rodney Reed.
Okay, Rodney Reed has been on death row for more than 22 years for the murder of a woman named Stacy Stites in Bastrop, Texas. Since his 1998 trial, there has been substantial evidence that exonerates him and implicates her then-fiancé, Jimmy Fennell, a former local police officer. Now, what's interesting is from the inception, Rodney Reed said, "I was having an affair with Stacy Stites." And he had basically nothing to corroborate that information. And consistent with his defense that he had had consensual sex with her, they found semen.
Well, it actually went the other way. They found semen in the postmortem and the autopsy, right? But it went the other way. What the prosecutors have said is that initially when asked whether or not he knew her, he denied knowing her, denied having a relationship with her. And then when they found the semen and the DNA match, then he said, "Oh, well, I had a consensual sexual relationship with her." And the prosecutors argued, predictably, "Well, how convenient." And there was no one there to corroborate it. But what have we learned since then?
Well, it turns out that now that the prosecutor has finally opened up their file, as defense lawyers were constantly asking for open file discovery, New York finally changed its law. And we receive or are supposed to receive everything in their file with certain exceptions. But When the state prosecutors released disclosure letters, they learned that other witnesses that they had spoken to also spoke about the possible consensual relationship between Stites and Rodney Reed. So that actually corroborated his defense. And that is in the, what really bothers me is when prosecutors know that they have information that says fact A, and then they vociferously and passionately argue during their closing arguments the exact opposite of that.
They mocked him. They mocked him and said, oh, yeah, sure. First you denied it. Now you're saying you had this consensual relationship. The only reason you're saying that is we found your DNA in the autopsy.
So just by way of background, he was granted an indefinite stay of execution in November of 2019 before COVID, literally 5 days before he was scheduled to die. And he's been awaiting a new hearing. That hearing started today. It's going to take place over several days. But Texas Court of Criminal Appeals ultimately argued that the lower court should consider Reed's innocence claims, which include 7 affidavits from witnesses who say that Stites and her fiancé, Jimmy Fallon, I believe, the police officer at the time, had an abusive and difficult relationship. And they also, again, provide evidence that Stites and Reed were having an affair at the time of her death. So in terms of exculpatory evidence that we expect will be presented to the judge, the time of death, which was critical because it either places Rodney Reed there or it doesn't, or it places...
It makes it possible for him to
right.
have done that.
Was apparently erroneous. So the actual time of death made it less likely that Rodney Reed could have killed her. Now witnesses, as I said earlier, corroborate that he was having a consensual relationship with Stacey Stites. And this was a trial that took place in the late 90s. And we haven't mentioned, but Rodney Reed is African-American. Stacey is white. And he was convicted by an all-white jury.
Go figure.
One assumes that they thought there's, you know, not a great likelihood that these two would be together or having an affair. Meanwhile, other forensic pathologists have concluded that his guilt is medically and scientifically impossible. There was zero forensic evidence other than the semen corroborating anything.
Zero evidence,
right.
Right. That is the evidence that ultimately led to his conviction. And the argument that we mentioned before that, well, you had first denied it, and now you're saying the consensual relationship, and they mocked him, all the while having witness statements corroborating his claim.
And I call him Jimmy Fallon, but he's actually Jimmy Fennell, her fiance at the time who worked at the police department. His best friend at the time of the crime, Bastrop Sheriff's Officer Curtis Davis, has recently revealed that Jimmy gave an inconsistent account of where he was on the night of the murder. So he originally told his friend he was out drinking on the night she was murdered. But later he said he was with Stacey in the apartment they shared during what we now know was the actual time of death. And then when asked to explain this discrepancy, he asserted his Fifth Amendment right, declined to testify because his answers might further incriminate him. Two other witnesses have recently come forward and submitted signed affidavits that add to more evidence against him. Among that evidence is someone who stated that Jimmy had threatened to kill her while he was applying for life insurance. A second witness came forward and claimed that he made some alarming and incriminating statements during her funeral. And later, Jimmy ended up getting convicted of it and served 10 years for a sex crime and kidnapping that he committed while he was on duty. So we know it's similar conduct that, you know, before Jimmy might have been a law-abiding, law-enforcing police officer with no criminal record. But had that come to light, we might think of him differently.
Well, we do think of him differently now.
And while he was in prison, it's alleged by a former member of the Aryan Brotherhood and his prison mate that Jimmy confessed to murdering Stacey, saying, "I had to kill my N-word-loving fiancé," in a conversation.
Well, look, this case is Rodney Reed. Google it and you can read more about it because it's fascinating. We should mention that part of the legal team representing him is the Innocence Project.
Our friends at the Innocence Project, they're doing a tremendous job.
Barry Scheck and another lawyer from the Innocence Project are down there fighting for this man's life and fighting to prove his innocence. Barry is somebody that you know. You worked at the Innocence Project for a while, and that we know from some of the work that we do now with cases. We've had some mutual clients. I'll be interested to chat with Barry one of these weeks about his work and in this case in particular. Let's move on to the next case that we spoke of, Mr. Glossop.
So Glossop's on death row in Oklahoma, along with Julius Jones, who we've mentioned before. He's been there for 23 years. Prior to that, he had no criminal record. He was charged and convicted of a murder of a hotel manager. And what's interesting is he didn't actually commit the murder, but they convicted him of commissioning the murder of Barry Van Treese in 97. And Glossop's attorney described new evidence that shows that far from a murder for hire plot, Justin Sneed, who's the confessed killer and the cooperating witness, hatched a plan with his girlfriend to rob him to support his raging meth addiction, and that Van Treese was killed when the robbery went bad. Now, informant testimony is the leading cause of wrongful convictions, specifically in death penalty cases. And Sneed, the guy who actually, he admits killing the guy, but he doesn't admit doing it with his girlfriend. He claims Richard Glossop paid him to do this. His coerced accusation was fed to him by police.
And there's a ton of evidence implicating him and implicating his girlfriend, right? I don't know if we have time to go through all of it, but there literally is a significant body of evidence.
Right, and including 29 new witnesses and experts that have come forward. So,
and his admission and boasting of having framed Mr. Glossop.
Well, multiple independent witnesses locked up with Sneed heard him say the murder was a robbery gone wrong carried out by Sneed and his girlfriend, and that Glossop had nothing to do with it. And at least to one witness, he bragged about framing Glossop.
Let's stop for a second, because people will say, oh, these are inmates in prison, and who would believe them, and they're not telling the truth, and that's not good evidence. But prosecutors use that kind of evidence all the time, as you just pointed out, to convict people. And not only do they use the evidence from witnesses who are in prison, they give them deals in order to induce them to testify. What possible motive does some person in prison have to give up his cellmate or somebody he's in prison with to a defense attorney who can't give them a dollar or a day less in jail?
Right. And
sorry, I digress a
no,
bit.
No, it's not, because look, whether or not you believe in the death penalty, I would hope that you, if you believe in it, you'd want substantial, overwhelming evidence of that individual's guilt. And here there was one single witness who had every motive in the world to lie, whose life was spared because he was facing the death penalty, who changed his story 8 different times, who multiple other witnesses say he's confessed to doing this on his own with his girlfriend. And so that isn't evidence that makes me confident that we should execute somebody.
Right, right. And there's that kind of doubt. One would think that the prudent, fair thing to do on behalf of the state or the government would be, okay, well, he was convicted. Defend the conviction if you can and if you want, but let's not kill him.
And I would just love for some journalist to take on the project of how much death penalty cases actually cost. Because Richard Glossop has endured 3 scheduled executions. The last one on September 30th, 2015, was not postponed until 45 minutes after he was supposed to be killed.
And that was not for any meritorious reason, simply because they couldn't get the protocol straight with the drug recipe to kill him.
The recipe.
Recipe, I don't know.
Recipe for murder, for state-sanctioned murder. But anyway, it cost millions of dollars to litigate and defend these cases, only to have them placed on death row, have higher security, spend more money, and then possibly not be executed for 20, 25 years when they are, if they were guilty, different people.
Right. Well, look, it is obviously an argument against the death penalty. We picked out these three cases for specific reasons. Obviously, Julius Jones, because you were involved in it, and he's got a very strong case for his innocence. Mr. Glossop and Mr. Reed, for similar reasons, and tell us the fact, what's similar between Glossop and Julius?
District Attorney Prater is opposing both those cases. He's the assigned DA, it's his county, and he won't disclose his file to either defense lawyer.
And look, we're lawyers. We do this all the time. When prosecutors say, you ask for something, they say, no, we're not going to give it to you, but we have it. It just makes you...
Makes you wonder.
Makes you wonder, and it makes you want it all the more.
Though, like, I've done this exercise in my head, and I'm like, if you refuse to turn over the file, let's assume because there's exculpatory evidence, and you're willing to hide that exculpatory evidence... One would think you might be willing to just destroy it and turn over the file and pretend. I'm not giving them any ideas. I'm sure they've thought about it. But
no, the witness statements and police reports like that are duplicated so many times in so many different places that it's literally, I think, impossible to destroy it all. But let's put a pin in this. We'll come back to these cases. Remember the names. Richard Glossop, Rodney Reed, Julius Jones. I want to take a moment. I want to get us to the story in 48 hours where two individuals, Lamar Johnson and Kevin Strickland, where the prosecutors agree that they were wrongly convicted, but the courts in Missouri won't let them out because of procedural bars or procedural hurdles.
And Aaron Moriarty just covered the case on 48 hours. So if you Google Lamar Johnson, Kevin Strickland, Aaron Moriarty, 48 hours, you'll find it. And you'll actually be able to hear from them from inside their jail cells. And it's pretty just, it's heartbreaking. Lamar Johnson has spent 25 years in prison. Kevin Strickland has spent 43. He's literally in his 60s now. And the prosecutors on their cases agree they're innocent and have issued public apologies. Strickland was sentenced in 1979 for, he was arrested for a triple homicide that was pretty brutal, obviously. And he was 18 years old at the time. He was home watching TV and talking on the phone when the crime occurred. And relatives confirmed his alibi at the time. Let me quote the prosecutor. What the prosecutor said is, in open court, my job is to apologize. It is important to recognize when the system has made wrongs and what we did in this case was wrong. So to Mr. Strickland, I am profoundly sorry. And they said this after discovering that the key witness and only victim to survive the attack recanted her story and realizing that there was wrongdoing and that they didn't pay attention.
And look, the people might wonder, if you're not in the weeds on this criminal procedure, how can somebody who's innocent, who the prosecutors say are innocent, how can they possibly stay in jail or in prison? And the answer is that different states have different laws, and not every state has a law that says if you're innocent or you can prove your innocence, you can get out.
Could you imagine hearing...
Think about what I just said.
Right, but could you imagine hearing that after 43 years? And this just happened recently, hearing, I am so sorry. We messed up. I messed up. I take responsibility for your wrongful conviction. And the hope that ensues immediately thereafter of your release and final vindication, only to be told, sorry, there's a procedural barrier that doesn't allow us to release you.
New York has no statute in place. Not no statute, but didn't have a statute in place to allow someone who's actually innocent to be released. And there was no method for this until 2014, People versus Hamilton. The courts finally recognized a freestanding claim of actual innocence. Before that, what you had to do in New York was you had to file a 440 motion or a motion, post-judgment motion, alleging some procedural defect. You couldn't simply file a claim saying, I didn't do this. Here's the proof that I didn't do this. You had to allege some other bar or some other violation of your rights, because the process, if the process was good and the result was bad, New York statute said too bad. And that's exactly what's happening in Missouri. New York has largely corrected that now, but not every state has. It's a system that has valued finality over correctness for decades. And it's a real problem. And people should take a look at this. Look at Erin Moriarty's great work. She was on our show a while ago, chatted about this a little bit. So it's a fascinating topic.
And I just don't buy that there's a procedural barrier that doesn't allow our justice system to release him. That's utter BS. The Attorney General of Missouri, Eric Schmidt, successfully fought the motion, arguing that because in Johnson's case, the man that's served 25 years, he claimed the verdict was final and he had run out of appeals, etc., and that prosecutors like Gardner don't have the power to ask for his release. But he didn't have to fight it. He could have consented. Well, it could have gone unopposed.
Topic for another day, when dealing with prosecutors and police who obtain convictions and defend them regardless of the merit, because they won't admit that they're wrong. We're going to come back in a few minutes. Don't go anywhere with Commissioner, Nassau Police Commissioner Patrick Ryder is our guest.
Welcome back to Crime and Justice Radio. I'm Aida Leisenring. I'm here with Bruce Barquette. And we have a very special guest we feel very fortunate to have. Nassau County Police Commissioner Patrick Ryder, who also has a master's degree in Homeland Security and Management from Long Island University, Riverhead Campus. He's an adjunct professor of criminal justice and intelligence-led policing at Nassau Community College, and he also taught at Dowling College since 2015. He's a husband, he's a father, and we're very lucky to have him.
And he's been a great police commissioner if you look at the statistics. Welcome, Commissioner. How are you?
Welcome. Thank you for having me, and I'm doing well. Thank you.
Excellent. So how good or how safe is Nassau?
We are the safest county in the country.
Says who?
Says U.S. News and reports, we've been rated the safest county in America. And then since that date, we lowered crime last year, 2020, but you really can't count that in anybody's books, right? But we still did lower it. And then this year, we're down another 10% in all of our major crime categories, including our homicide, which as of today is down 40%.
And homicide, I'm seeing a lot in news reports that, you know, the crime statistics are skewed and they don't really mean what they mean. And they often say it's really only homicides are up in these particular, you know, cities and counties. And I'm like, well, that's kind of the only one I really, really care about.
Well, homeowners care about burglaries, too.
True. But how have you lowered homicides in Nassau County when other counties see it elevated?
Because everything they talked about in police reform, they talked about focused deterrence, intelligence-led policing, evidence-based policing. We've been doing that since I got into asset forfeiture back in 2000, shortly before 9/11. And what happened was I met a gentleman down on the pile, Chauncey Parker. He heads the New York, New Jersey HIDA office, high-intensity drug trafficking areas. And he said to me, he goes, you need an intel center. We need satellites. We got to do better at sharing intelligence. And he's looking at it from a global perspective. He's looking at terrorism, and that's what, you know, everybody was focused on at the time. I went back to my lieutenant at the time, then back to the commissioner, and we started an intel center. And we were one of the first to have a HIDA office. And from there, our crime numbers have always gone down. We had a couple of years where we plateaued, but for the most part, we're down 36% since 2010.
So I mentioned burglaries before, and I know that burglaries are down in Nassau County. How has that happened? What have you done to combat residential burglaries?
Well, we created our burglary pattern team. We put four chosen detectives and one sergeant, and we said, we're going to give you the best intelligence. You have all the resources. I don't need to create an army. If you look at intelligence-led policing, it's effective and efficient use of resources driven by the data, not the old style, which was flood the area with cops, you push the crime out, you then have to leave because you can't sustain it, and the crime comes back. Once you displace the crime, it's always going to come back. So what we did was, by intelligence-led policing, you go into a community, you choose the bad culprits, the bad people, 90% of the crime done by 10% of the population. Focus on them. Not because of their race, their religion. It doesn't matter. Those 10 guys are bad guys. We got to go get them. The other 90 people, let them go about their business. And you do that through gathering intel, the proper intel. You do that by sharing that intel. We're an open book to all of our law enforcement community. We're always sharing, along with the NYPD, who's been a great partner to us. We gather that information up. We put the burglary pattern team. They went after these burglars. We used to average on a weekend in Nassau County 30 burglaries a weekend and throughout the county. Again, large community, very congested.
Well, large community, and for people who don't know this, a large community right next to Queens, right next to New York City, high intensity residential community, really the bedroom community for New York City. And so you're saying 30 burglaries a weekend or 30 burglaries a night.
And so on the average, we do 14 to 2,000 burglaries a year. Last year, we did less than 300. This year, we're down. We're down another 12%. That's unheard of. And the reason we're doing it is because we're focused. We didn't get distracted with protest. We didn't get distracted with reform. We said, okay, if reform's going to tell me I have to do it this way, discovery, bail, and everything else, well, then we got to go after them a second time. We had a burglary crew out of South America that would come in out of Chile. They'd come in, they hit us, and they knew they were getting out. We set up, and as soon as they got out, we set up on them. They did a second burglary, we'd lock them up again. After the third burglary, we actually got to keep them in jail. And it was only because the law was written that an attempted burglary would hold them, but and it was one that they did an attempt on. That kept them in jail, not the actual burglary themselves.
I feel like I represented one of those people, and I think I did a really good job because I got him out. But what's interesting is you mentioned bail reform, and I talk to people in our criminal justice community all the time, be it prosecutors, judges, defense lawyers, and when we all wonder, like, you know, why is crime rising? A lot of people say, oh, because of bail reform, and I don't want that to be the answer because I don't think there should be preventative detention because that's not what the law is. And I don't think people that are poor should stay in versus people that can afford, charged with the same crime, get out. What are your views on that? Do you think bail reform has impacted, I would say, the rising crime rates in Nassau, but Nassau has bail reform and I haven't seen a rise.
So when you look at bail reform, what it's done to the country, and what it's done to the state of New York, it's hurt it in certain areas that have a larger volume of arrests. We don't have that larger. We average about 30 to 50 arrests a day in Nassau County. Outside, you know, 30 to 50 is one precinct in the city of New York. So obviously they're going to have a bigger turnaround. They're going to have more people that are going to commit more crimes, and that recidivism rate will rise. But Nassau County, we didn't have the large volume. We still had too many that got out and came back. I'm a very moderate and middle of the road thinker. When it came to bail reform, I'm exactly like you. Rich kids should not get out over poor kids. Bail was not meant for that purpose, and unfortunately, it went that way for many, many years. But you should never take the discretion away from the judge and the district attorney, and even the police, because they make the recommendations to the DA, and say, this guy's a bad guy. This guy's been, first of all, he's coming from another country. He's committing crimes here on purpose, and we have a pattern that shows they're going to go back after they've committed these crimes. We got to work together on this, and we got to make sure we're focused on keeping this guy in jail, not the other 90%. You know, they're not committing crimes. They're good, hardworking people in the community. So it's a challenge for law enforcement. Bail reform came up with discovery and the amount of time we have to turn all of that discovery information over. And, you know, if we didn't reach that, they couldn't answer ready for trial. They couldn't answer ready for hearings and stuff. So it's a big challenge. The onus is put back on us. So we have to rise to the occasion and answer those checks, check those boxes, while other measures are being fought on the other side.
Now,
it makes sense to you.
It does. It does. And we don't necessarily disagree with what you're saying. We all look. I live in Nassau County. I want it to be a safe place. I have kids. I have a home. I don't want my home broken into. And we all feel the same way about that. You mentioned the smart policing, the intelligence, the focused on it. I wonder how you feel about the kind of what I would describe as, or used to be described as, the broken window policing. You strictly enforce low-level criminal offenses, and as a result of doing that, you somehow stop the flow or the tide of more crimes. And obviously, what's happening now is you have bail reform. People aren't being held on that. The cases aren't being treated as seriously. The punishment isn't as severe. People are given appearance tickets and so forth. Is that part of your plan? Has that been part of your plan when it comes to enforcing the law and keeping the crime rates down?
I think broken windows theory was a mastermind. It was a great program. It's still a great program. I still use it today. Broken windows is not broken. People are broken, meaning this. We went and times changed. We didn't adjust. We didn't adjust to the change. The laws changed. We didn't adjust. So law enforcement, look, in reform, yeah, we got some work to do. But broken windows is the basis of what people pay their taxes for, quality of life, you know, safety in their communities. They want to be able to walk to the ice cream store and not be accosted like's going on in the city of New York. Out here in Nassau County, thank God it's not happening. Why? Because we still believe in that quality of life. The difference is you have to shift away from minor infractions and approach it a different way. And maybe that's a community outreach. You know, I'm getting complaints now. People are very upset. You know, they live near houses that people are smoking marijuana because marijuana is legal right now, or alcohol and drinking and loud parties at night, fireworks, motorcycles. Okay, we're going to go in. We're going to do some enforcement, but not kind of selective, meaning, look, we're not looking to hammer you. We're just looking to send you a warning. Guys, I got it. I know marijuana is legal right now. You know it and I know it. They got a young family over there. So we send up pop cops in. And they become that, they diffuse that problem in that community. Talk to both sides. Let's see if we can mediate a happy area somewhere and everybody's good. We're not the lawmakers. We're not politicians. We're the people that have to enforce what's given to us, but at the same time, maintain that quality of life like in broken windows. How do you deal with homelessness, right? And it's a big problem. And it's mostly at our train stations now. We approach them every day. We ask them, do you need housing? Can we offer you some assistance? We have pamphlets and flyers and contact that we can push them to another place, meaning a place that will give them a housing. They have the right to stay there. We can't kick them out of there. We got that. But we can make them offers that maybe sometimes is better for them and better for the community, meaning they get housing. They get a good solid meals and stuff to get themselves back on their feet.
So,
we're working very hard on a lot of those issues.
And of course, a lot of these stories aren't what's written about, right? And it sounds like you're encouraging or implementing programs to help people that need help, right? Because policing isn't just arresting. But obviously, police have come under bad reputations, and we're hearing about it day after day after day, and it feels like it's not stopping. And what I want to know, because I, you know, have friends of my family are in the police communities in Pennsylvania and in other areas, what is it like today being a police officer in the community?
It's difficult. It's difficult because the challenges, the law changes that are coming at, and they're not coming in pieces. They're coming all in one. Right, they've been slamming us since back in January of 2000, when 2020, right? So they started hitting us, and they hit us pretty hard, and then reform came, then the unrest, then COVID, and then more unrest. It's just been a barrage against law enforcement.
How do you keep up morale for your department?
Because, and it's not just me; it's all my bosses, but I walked with my cops through just about 70-80% of the protests. And I'd say to my cop, I'd go to, how you doing? And the guy would go, boss, I'm good. I'm good. I go, engage. Engage with the protesters. Say hello. What do you mean? And you go up and you say hello to somebody, they go, F you. You know what? Move to the next person. And then the next person. By the end of almost every single protest we had here in Nassau County, my cops will tell you, people would walk back to their cars saying, thank you, officers, for looking out for us. So they had a First Amendment right. We protected their First Amendment right. They were, for the most part, peaceful.
How many people got arrested?
We had 14 arrests with over 60,000 people come through our county.
Wow.
That's
wow.
It?
And most of them happened, and most of them were done with an appearance ticket.
So,
at the end of the night, we're going to give you the ticket for the violation which occurred during the protest.
So let me ask a slightly different question. You mentioned politics before. And I, you know, you've been a police officer's police officer, a cop's cop, as they say. You walked the streets. You were a line officer in New York City, then you moved out here, and you were a cop in the 80s. But now you're the commissioner, which means that's sort of a political position. How have you handled not just enforcing the law and running a police department, but navigating the political waters that exist?
That's probably the most complicated part of my day. And I work for a Democrat, and I'm a Republican. I always tell people this. But I have the greatest boss in the world. She respects decisions because my decisions are not based on politics. They're based on facts. They're based on what's going on in the world, right? So what works for this community? And every community is different. You know, there's an old saying from Robert Peel, who was the founding father, right? He would say, police are the community as the community are the police. We have to work together. We have to be one. There's no way around it. My outreach to my community started from day one when I created the Commissioners Community Councils. And I spread it out through the 19 legislative districts. And the legislators, they're cool. They're all good about it. And they're not involved in it. They let us work together because it gives us a diverse look. We continue to build on that. We continue community councils. We have a youth council now in every precinct. We have our PALs, our community affairs, our pop cops. It's about addressing people want service for what they pay.
Well, how,
and I tell my cops that all the time.
How are you? You said diversity, and I don't want to get into stuff that's old news, but tell us how Nassau Police Department is trying to make itself more diverse, more inclusive.
The challenge we have, and look, we all know the story. I got in trouble for
that. Yeah, we don't want to go back into it. I'm not interested in repeating history, but go ahead.
I'll tell you this. There are no broken homes, right? There's single-family homes and very successful, many of them. It was my bad choice of words, and I apologize to those I offended. My point of that whole conversation was to get young men and women that want to come onto our job, assistance to help them along the process. We built a mentoring program. We have over 100 kids in a mentoring program. The problem is the volume of people that I bring in. So if 13,000 white people take the test, and I only have 1,100 African Americans take the test, and another, I think it was 2,000 or 2,400 Hispanics take the test, I'm never going to get the diversity that we want to get at because it's a scored, and it's just, I may have all 1,100 score the top of the test, and that's great. I hire them all because it's by the numbers. That's the way it works. So it's a challenge. Our mentoring program has done a lot of success. We're building on my biggest issue right now, and I tell people this all the time, I need to bring volume to the test. I need, if I'm going to equal the game, I got to bring as many players from each team in to help out and get them on the test, and I'll get the numbers better. And that's my problem. I have to do better at recruitment and get more people in to take the test.
Let me switch gears here. It was recently announced that the Republican nominee for district attorney in Nassau County is going to be Ann Donnelly. What are your thoughts?
Wow. I just left the softball field, so I didn't know. I know Ann Donnelly. I know Ann Donnelly for 30, probably as long as she's been a DA, because I was a cop before she was. So I know Ann my entire career. Ann's a wonderful person, wonderful family person, great kids. She's a great prosecutor. I don't get involved in the politics, so I won't choose one side or the other. I will hopefully the best person wins, and the person that wins works with law enforcement to do what's right to serve the people of Nassau County.
That's
hopefully works with the defense bar too, because we see the other side. I'll be Southern for a moment. Y'all make the arrest. The prosecutor prosecutes them, and we see what happens when one individual gets, you know, a different sentence than another individual based on, you know, the circumstances and the victims, and that's difficult for us. But in a weird way, we're all in the same business, and we ought to be working together.
To some degree. To some degree.
Except at trial.
To some degree.
Well, I will say this. On our PAC team, we have, and I won't use his name because I don't know if he wants it out there, but we have a member from the defense counsel that's there, and he's hard. He's hard on me because he's seen what I don't see. So, and he says to me, he goes, Pat, you need to change this. And you know, some of it I agree, and some of it I don't, but that's what this is about. You know, we're always going to have them disagreements, but we need to do better serving all the people.
Hey, you look, great job. Keep up the good work. Thanks so much for a few minutes with us. Too few minutes, but we got to run. Good luck. Stay strong. Keep Nassau safe.
Keep up the good work with the clearance rate. It's astounding.
Right. Thanks, Commissioner. We appreciate you coming on.
Thank you for giving me the time, and have a great night. Thanks.
Bye.
Hey, what an interesting show in some ways. I love doing this. Look, we just talked about five people who were potentially wrongfully convicted, three of whom are looking at the death penalty. We took a short break, we switched gears, and we had on a police commissioner for 20 minutes to talk about a whole range of issues.
Hopefully most of it made sense.
Enough of it made sense. It's one of the things I love doing about this. Hopefully people like listening to it because it's fun.
Or we should go back to Robert Durst stories and catheter bags and socialites arrested.
That'll come. We'll see you next week on Crime and Justice Radio.
Bye.
The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, JVC Broadcasting Management, or its sponsors.